Welcome to the Sermon Podcast of Washington Avenue Christian Church. I'm Jim Shelburne, Senior Pastor. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
What was God thinking? Now that we're on the other side of Easter and all of the dyed eggs have been found and hopefully all of the Reese's peanut butter eggs have been thrown into the garbage, can we just rewind to Friday again? For just a moment, can we just ask ourselves the question, what was God thinking? That may be a question that makes some of you uncomfortable, and if so, let me just tell you, that's okay. It's frankly a question that makes me a little bit uncomfortable as well, but I wonder if part of the reason that asking the question makes us uncomfortable is because we're just generally uncomfortable with asking God very many questions. Our understanding of faith has just kind of been boiled down to a blind acceptance of seemingly impossible and impractical, unbelievable proclamations. We're kind of like the children, you know, who are told about the jolly fat man who travels all over the world in one night, visiting every single kid in the world and leaving them the gifts that they asked for. We just kind of blindly accept it, even though it seems implausible and impractical, even irrational. We have questions, but those questions stem from doubts, and doubts are bad, and so we push them down. We shelve our questions and our doubts, and we go on doing the things that we believe and have been told that good Christians must do. And at the end of our lives, we kind of find ourselves thinking and wondering, have we really made the right decision? Are we really in the right spot? Did everything that I didn't do really make what I did do worth it? And friends, when I look at the Bible, that's not the picture of faith that I see. Look no further than the book of Job, right? In the midst of Job's pain, in the midst of his loss, Job asks God questions. He doesn't simply shove his fists further into his pockets and stretch a smile over his tear-stained face and return to his job as the door greeter at the church. No, Job questions God. He doesn't divorce himself from the idea of God. He doesn't end his connection with God. Rather than pretending that everything was okay and going back to business as usual, Job withdraws to himself. He eliminates the noise and the advice and the distractions, and he simply goes into a place by himself and does something, frankly, fascinating. Job gets angry with God. He gets angry with God, and he questions, God, why are you doing this? And friends, what if, rather than letting our questions be a warning flag of a failing faith, we allow our questions to draw us into a deeper relationship with God? That was certainly what happened with Job. You see, God listened to Job's frustrations and his complaints and his pain, and then God responded. God said, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you will answer me." And for the next four chapters, Job, because of his questions, gets one of the clearest glimpses of the power and might of God in the entire Bible. And hear me, friends. Some of you have lost jobs. Some of you, unfortunately, have lost loved ones. And all of us have lost the comfort of routine and normal. And it's okay to share your pain with God. It's okay to ask God questions. Some of you may be thinking and wondering, well, at least Job got the answers that he was looking for. Where are my answers? God, all I've been met with is silence. And friends, that also is a valid question to which I would point you to men like David and men like Jesus, who at two separate times in history cry out to God, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And then are met with silence. Let me just encourage you, keep pursuing God even in the silence. So back to our question then, what was God thinking? A crucified Christ sounds to me like jumbo shrimp or married bachelor or tasty spaghetti. It's a contradiction of terms, right? It is defining itself out of existence, this idea of a crucified Christ. Now, maybe not to you and me who live on the other side of history. We know the rest of the story. But if I could invite you just for a moment to put yourselves in the shoes of a first century Jewish commoner. The Christ was the one who was supposed to lead God's people out from under the rule and reign of the oppressive Roman Empire and to establish God's kingdom on earth forever. And crucifixion, well, it was the tool of the oppressive Roman Empire, primarily used for doing away with pesky would-be kings. It was violent, and it was painful, and it was effective. A crucified Christ, what in the world was God thinking? It sounds like absolutely utter and complete foolishness. And it's here, friends, that I want to remind you that we're picking up in our series, 2020 Vision. We took a break for Easter last week, but we're diving right back in this week. And if you'll remember, pillar number 4 of what it takes to be a community sold out for Jesus in 2020 was that we must be a community committed to the foolishness of God. So what was God thinking? A crucified Christ sounds absolutely foolish. Well, friends, that's exactly what the Corinthian church was thinking too. And if we're going to be hanging out with the Corinthians this morning, which, by the way, we are, let me just introduce you to them a little bit, if I could. The city of Corinth, it was located about 40 miles to the south-southwest of the city of Athens, and it enjoyed colony status by the Roman Empire, which means, as we've talked about before, let me just give you a quick reminder, they have a more favored status in the empire. They pay fewer taxes. The citizens of Corinth are automatically citizens of the Roman Empire without having to purchase that right or privilege, which means that they are therefore entitled to a trial by a jury and are safe from the threat of crucifixion, among many, many other perks as well. The city of Corinth was actually said to be a generally superficial cultural life. They had a pretty generally superficial cultural life. Julius Caesar established the city of Corinth under his rule, and he populated it with upwardly mobile, free people. And that mentality lingered in the city of Corinth up to and through the time of Paul writing his letters to them in around 54 to 55 AD, which is approximately 17 years after the death of Jesus. Now, the wealthy people in Corinth, they were described as disgusting and coarse and objectionable. There is a historian named Aristophanes, and this historian coined the term Corinthiazo, which simply meant to act like a Corinthian, specifically in regards to sexual conduct and fornication. All people of Corinth were described as without grace or without charm, and not the least bit friendly or enjoyable to be around. It sounds to me like a great place to raise a family. Not at all. And if that wasn't bad enough, the Corinthians were notorious for dividing themselves into subgroups in order to elevate their status in the community. And when you read Paul's letter, it will give evidence that the Corinthian reputation, both as a city and as a church, it's well deserved. I want to be clear here for just a minute. While at first glance, the book of 1 Corinthians, the letter of 1 Corinthians, may look like a letter primarily concerned with how to act as a Christian, it is through and through an argument for the unity in Christ and a deconstruction of all the subdivisions that the Corinthian church had built for themselves. I mentioned this earlier, but I want to backpedal just a little bit. Corinth was only 40 miles from Athens, which meant that over the years, the philosophy and, quote, wisdom from Athens and men like Aristotle and Socrates and Plato, who resided at different points in history in Athens, had no doubt trickled down the road and had significant impact on how the Corinthians thought. And in a city with little to no virtue at all, wisdom, by its worldly standards, was worth its weight in gold. Now, Paul spends the first small section of his letter to the 1 Corinthians deconstructing their subdivision that they had created for themselves of who was most important based on who had baptized them. Some were baptized by Apollo, some were baptized by Peter, some by Paul. And so they argued about who was most important because of that. And after deconstructing this argument, Paul shifts his primary focus to this divisive virtue, wisdom. We'll be in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Verse 18, where Paul says, "For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to those of us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, both Jew and Greek, Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength." And friends, here's the problem with wisdom. It allows for, and even really relies on, human judgment and evaluation. But the gospel, the cross of Christ, the crucified Messiah, stands in divine antithesis to such judgments. No one in his right mind, no one in his craziest, wildest dreams would have conceived or dreamed up of God's scheme for redemption. A redemption that comes through a crucified Christ. It is just absolutely too preposterous, absolutely too humiliating for a God to do. And in spite of its humiliation, this is the method that God chose to use to begin the end. A new creation, a new age has broken into the old world. The structure of the old world, stained by the power of sin, is already, right now, passing away. Sin in all of its forms, greed and gluttony, divorce and deception, lying and laziness, are all passing away. And not only is sin passing away, but the same can be said for the consequences of sin. Anxiety and depression, anger and rage and COVID-19 and ultimately death have all been dethroned by the crucified Christ. And it is here, friends, that Paul makes or tries to make a very clear distinction. There are only two real groups of people. Not rich and poor, and not wise and foolish, not even Jew and Greek. The only two groups of people that matter is those who are perishing and those who are being saved. And I want to, for just a moment, if you'll allow me to, take just a moment to dive into the grammar here. And some of you are moaning and sighing on your couch, and you've decided that this might be a good spot to go refill your coffee or anything, and that's fine if you want to, but I think that when we understand and see what Paul does with the grammar here, we can draw out a really, really interesting application. It gives us some really interesting clues. You see, those who are perishing is from the Greek word, and I've tried all week to get this right, and I'm still stumbling over it, so bear with me, or laugh at me. Either one is fine. Apollumenoisis. I think that's about right. Apollumenoisis. And in this form, it is what we call a present middle participle. Present tells us that it is currently in the process of happening. And that middle word tells us that the subject is both an agent of an action and somehow concerned with the action. And that's a lot of words. Basically, here's what that means. That they are in control of their own fate because of their choices. And that fate is playing out right now. when we shift to those who are being saved, it's very, very similar, with one striking difference. Those who are being saved is a present passive participle. So just like the previous statement, it is currently in the process of happening, but it is passive, which means that the action being saved is done to the subject. So what does this all mean? It means that those who are perishing are solely responsible for their fate. And those who are being saved are not responsible for the saving action at all. God has done and will continue to do the act of saving all on his own. It also means that for those who are perishing, that there is still hope. It is a present participle, not a past participle, which means that it has not concluded happening yet. The action is not completed yet. There is still time to join the only other group that matters. As Paul sees it, the fate of each group, both those who are perishing and those who are being saved, has not yet been sealed. It is a process still underway. Salvation is something that is to be completed by God in the future. And at present, believers, the ones in God's called community, us, are justified. We are restored in our relationship with God. Believers are in the process of moving towards salvation, while those who are perishing are on the course of, well, perishing. And what Paul is doing here is everything that he possibly can to refute the current Corinthian stances. Wisdom, their thing, and the cross, God's thing, stand in absolute contradiction to one another. And even more than that, the foolish thing, the cross, God's thing, is where God was pleased to demonstrate his saving power and redeeming grace on behalf of all mankind. And well, frankly, all of this is highly problematic to what Jews believed are the only two groups of people that mattered, Jews and Gentiles. See, for Jews, the whole idea of a crucified Christ is a stumbling block. The Greek word there is skandalon, and I hope that you hear our English word scandal there. Rather than something that someone trips over, a stumbling block, whenever I think of a stumbling block, it's something that I like trip over and then continue along on my way. And that's not really what Paul is trying to say here, and I think scandal does a better job of translating it than stumbling block like your NIV has. A scandal is something that offends to the point of arousing suspicion. And you don't really have to look very much further than the previous life of Paul when he was Saul, as a Jew, hearing about the crucified and risen Messiah, Jesus, to know that he didn't just like stumble about it and think, ah, what an inconvenience, and continue moving on. No, Saul shifted his entire focus to eradicating the movement of the church. Something that drew out of him opposition. You see, Jews' mistake was that they had God figured out. They thought, and they were expecting, for their redemption to come in the form of that similar to Moses and the Exodus. Power from God, just on an even more greater and splendid scale. And the crucified Christ was neither powerful nor splendid. And to the Greeks, the Gentiles, it's simply foolish, which was kind of Greeks' national characteristic, right? It is said that they were zealous for all forms of wisdom. And their idolatry was to conceive of God as the ultimate reason, meaning, of course, only what they deemed to be reasonable. But when I look at our world, is this still not, to some extent, the issue? These are the two basic idolatries still, right? Power and wisdom. Always on our behalf and for our point of view. So what do we do with this, you may be asking yourself? Well, if you look at it, this is kind of how we weigh status in our time, right? There are lots of things by which we weigh power and status, but one of those is surely what we know, education. And Paul devalues the status of what we might claim to know by our knowledge and expertise. But at the same time, and I want to be very clear here, he does not oppose or discredit the use of God-given minds and wisdom. What counts is not what one knows, but by whom one is known. Which really, I believe, for us, raises an important issue that has remained an issue throughout church history. There has always been, for us, a temptation to transform Christianity from a matter of proper relation to God into a question of holding the right beliefs or opinions or ideas or agreeing with certain propositions. Christianity is and always has been about our relationship to God through Jesus. Paul calls this faith, meaning a proper trusting dependence on God to do what God has promised to do. Some churches want to stress that the real test of belonging is in our affirmation to certain doctrinal claims and having the right ideas and beliefs. And Paul would be completely unfamiliar with this idea. The cross, even in its foolishness, and our response to it is what mends our shattered relationship with God. Nothing else. So what was God thinking? Maybe God was thinking that a crucified Christ was the best way to get our attention. Paul continues on his journey through the deconstruction of wisdom in verse 26. He says, "Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, that is, our righteousness and holiness and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts boast in the Lord." Now, if you've heard me talk very much at all, you might know that I'm a pretty big sports fan, which means that I've been pretty miserable for about a month now because there has been zero sports on my television at all, much to my wife's delight and enjoyment. I love sports. I watch a lot of sports. I also like to listen to and watch a lot of sports talk shows, and they're very much in a similar position as me. They don't have much to talk about right now, and so they've kind of developed these hypothetical questions, and one of the most fascinating hypothetical questions that they've been asking really for a couple of years now, but has come into prominence since they don't have anything else to talk about, is this. If you were to start a brand new franchise, what one player would you want to build your entire franchise around? I won't speak to the NBA, but to just put a little bit of flesh on this, let me talk about the NFL for just a minute. It's pretty much unanimously understood that if you were to start a brand new NFL team in Amarillo, Texas, the one guy that you would want to build your team around, the first player that you would want on your roster is Patrick Mahomes. Which makes me happy because I'm a Texas Tech fan. If you don't know Patrick Mahomes, he just won the Super Bowl with the Kansas City Chiefs. He's in his third season, and he won the Super Bowl MVP. In his second season, he won the league MVP. So he's kind of a really good football player. But that's not the only reason that people want to build around him. People want to build around him because he's humble, and because he's articulate, and because he's a leader of men. He draws out the best from his team. It is pretty much universally understood that if you were to start a new franchise today, you would want Patrick Mahomes first. Let me shift the question just a little bit. If you were to plant a brand new church today, who would you recruit first? whenever I was at Ozark Christian College, I actually took some church planting courses. I was kind of interested in church planting, but mostly it's because we got to go to New York City like 4 or 5 times throughout the school year, basically like for free, really, really cheap, and I like going to New York City. And so I took these courses and I got to go hang out in New York City with people who had planted churches. And we sat down across the room from these people, and we were able to ask them a lot of questions. And it was a really great time. One question that came up to every single church planter that we asked was, who are you looking for to start a new church? And of course, the answers were pretty varied based off of who was in the neighborhood, you know, the target neighborhood and who, what kind of demographic was there. And of course, you know, the lost is a pretty important people to have in a brand new church. But one universal answer stood out to me. He said, they all said, we're looking for high capacity potential givers, people who buy into the mission of the church and then are able to channel their funds to help the church execute its mission, right? We need people like that. Church, running a church is expensive, and running a church in New York City is really, really expensive. Planting a church in New York City is really, really expensive. So they all agreed we would recruit high capacity potential givers. God chose the Corinthians, all right? Let's just think about that for a second. The same graceless, dull, unfriendly, disgusting, coarse, and objectionable Corinthiazos. That's who God chose to start his church in Corinthians, or in Corinth. What was God thinking? Paul here points out in the text that not many of them were wise or influential or of noble birth. God chose them. His point in getting them to consider themselves is that in calling out a people for his name, God showed no regard for their present value, no regard for worldly wisdom or merit. In fact, in calling the Corinthians, God specifically chose those who were living in direct contradiction to those values. Just think with me for a moment, if you will. If God were to operate by human standards of wisdom, do you honestly believe that God would have chosen the Corinthians? No. If God were to operate by human standards of wisdom, do you honestly think that God would have chosen you? Me? No. The irony of their present situation is that these Corinthians are judging Paul and his gospel from this worldly wisdom point of view, which, were they to apply that to themselves, only serves to show just how insignificant they really are. Through Christ crucified, and by God's subsequent calling of the Corinthians to be participants in glory, God has already chosen the things that are not that they don't exist, but that they are literally nothing, to render ineffective the things that are in power. God has already begun his vindication over his enemies, and friends, he is using you and me to bring about that victory. It might sound crazy to you, but the fact of the matter is that God has excelled at bringing about his plan for salvation throughout broken, messed up people throughout history. All you have to do is look at the Old Testament, right? Moses was a murderer who couldn't talk well, and Abraham was a liar and a coward, and Noah was a drunk, and that's just in the first two books of the Bible, that God uses broken men to bring about his plan. What was God thinking? Probably that his power is made complete in our weakness. And as we've walked through the text this morning, we have seen Paul systematically deconstruct the Corinthian idol of wisdom by showing that God absolutely rejects the notion of human wisdom and flips it on its head by doing what no one would have expected to execute his plan. The crucified Christ secures the victory, and the lowly Corinthian believers and us? Well, we show that victory to the world. But Paul isn't done yet. When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I came to you in weakness and fear with much trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise or persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith may not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power. And you may be thinking to yourself, that's really cool, Shane. It's neat and nice that Paul would do that. But why is it important for me, Shane? I'm not a preacher. Would you allow me just maybe to share with you two observations, two thoughts that I have in response to that question? Here's the first. I'm going to assume that all of you said yes, because I didn't hear any no's. So we're going to move forward. Here's my first thought. We have a really great pastor here at Washington Avenue Christian Church. We have a really great preacher here at Washington Avenue Christian Church. And if we're being honest, I think that we have a really great team of preachers here at Washington Avenue Christian Church. And we're also doing a really great job of developing even more great preachers. And one thing that I am confident in, and I hope will always be true for them, is that the principles that Paul lays out here are lived out and prayed out at this church. And if I may, just for a moment, I want to give you just my promise to you. As long as I am here, in whatever capacity I am privileged to be here in, I will proclaim the crucified and resurrected Jesus. I'm not that old, and I'm certainly not that wise. I don't know a lot about marriage or about family raising or child raising or finances. I don't know much about anything, but one thing I do know. Christ died according to the Scriptures. He was buried and rose again 3 days later according to the Scriptures. He appeared to Peter and to the 12. And after that, he appeared to more than 500 of the other brothers and sisters, and then to James, and then to Paul. And way, way, way down the road, he appeared also to me. So every message that you get from me will be about this truth. And you should expect that of every single person who plants their feet on this platform, friends. We are a Jesus church. And people pick which church they're going to attend based off of a lot of different reasons, worship and children's programming and youth. But one of the primary reasons is preaching. Can I be honest? Can I be frank with you for a moment? If you choose a church based off of the eloquence or the charisma or the popularity of the preacher, well, you're choosing a church based on the wrong criteria. You should choose a church based off of how often and how boldly they proclaim Jesus and how well they equip you to participate in the mission of seeking and saving the lost. If you're checking us out for the first time this morning online, or if you've been following along with us through our online experiment over what's now been 5 weeks, may I just say, I love Washington Avenue Christian Church, and I truly believe that Washington Avenue Christian Church is a place that boldly proclaims Jesus and equips its people to execute the mission of seeking and saving the lost, and it's a great place for you to belong. We would love to meet you and figure out what your next steps can be right now and what your next steps can be once this whole quarantine thing is over. So if that's something that you're interested in, would you take just a moment and let us know, like in the comments right there, or you can email us at info@whackonline.org or private message us on Facebook. Just let us know. We would love to meet you and get to know you on a more personal level and get you plugged in here at Washington Christian Church. I love this church, and I would love to see you be a part of it as well. That was thing number one. Here's thing number two. Contrary to popular belief, you are a preacher. Not because you went to school for it, and not because you know a ton about the Bible or because you are a great speaker. You are a preacher because you are a Christian. And like it or not, you are the vessel that God has chosen to proclaim his redemptive story to the world. Paul says that he came in weakness and fear with much trembling. Can I tell you just a little bit about me? I shouldn't be standing here this morning. If you were to ask my ninth grade speech teacher, Mrs. Venhouse would tell you that Shane Wiley in ninth grade was a scrawny, poorly dressed stick of a kid who shook so badly in his speeches that he would often get lost and get overwhelmed and have to start totally over. I hated giving speeches. It was absolutely embarrassing to me. I was shy and I was quiet. I wasn't very well known. I kept my head down, and most days in high school I went home for lunch by myself. But I knew that God had called me to kingdom work. So I went to Ozark Christian College. And when I got to Ozark Christian College, I was paired up with a roommate named Stephen Einan, who's one of my best friends in the whole world today. And Stephen Einan was a walking Ken doll. Like, that's just the best way that I can describe him. He was muscular and good looking. He was just a really, like, just a stellar human being. And not only was he good looking, he was eloquent and charismatic and really, really smart. He was the salutatorian of our class and one of the best preachers in our class as well. And for the first couple of years of my time at Ozark Christian College, I wasn't really known by Shane so much as I was known by, hey, you're Einan's roommate, right? Yes, I am. And I tell you that to tell you this. If I can go from the shy, scrawny, shaking kid to standing up here on this platform this morning, you can too. Not because of anything that I did, or not because of anything that you did, but because of everything to do with what God will and can do through you. God is in the process of overturning the world's systems, and part of the way that God is choosing to do that is using the foolish things to overcome the wise, the weak things to overcome the strong, the shy things to overcome the bold. And the power of our witness is ultimately God's power, and God has been pleased to make that power effective through all sorts of cracked and damaged vessels, just like you and me. So I don't know what all of this might mean for you, but here's what I think are maybe just a couple of natural next steps as we wrap up this morning. Maybe some of you watching have never accepted the foolishness of a crucified Christ before. The reason that you haven't doesn't really matter to me. I don't care that much about why you haven't, but I would love to hear that you have. There's an opportunity for you this morning to make that wisest decision that you will ever make in your life and put your faith in the foolishness of God. If that is something that you want to talk about, if that's something that you're feeling compelled to do, would you help us out and let us know either through an email or through a private message or right there in the comments if you're bold enough to do that. We want to celebrate with you. We want to reach out to you and get you plugged in so that, again, we can figure out what your next step at Washington Avenue Christian Church, and more importantly than that, your next step in your walk with Jesus will look like. Most of us, I think, are in the second group, and it's the group that has never shared their faith with anyone because you feel like you don't know what to say or how well to say it. Friends, Paul doesn't care about that. And more importantly, Jesus doesn't care about that. You don't have to speak well or know enough. You just have to be willing. Here's something that I've learned in my journey with Jesus. Jesus does not call the qualified. Jesus qualifies the called. And friends, every single one of us is called. So here's what I want to challenge you with this morning. Leave the name of someone that you know needs to hear about the foolishness of the cross, maybe for the first time, or maybe for the 100th time. Leave that name in the comments. But don't stop there, that's lazy. Have a conversation with them about that foolishness of Jesus. Here's why I want you to leave it in the comments, is because you have a lot of cheerleaders right here in this room. There are elders and staff here that want to pray for you. We've been praying for you all morning. We want to pray for you now as you go and share the foolishness of Jesus with a lost and broken world. So help us by leaving that name in the comments. Help us pray for you, that God gets you out of the way and speaks powerfully and boldly through you. And help us pray for that person, that God would strip them of their reason and what they think is wise and show them the foolishness of the cross. What was God thinking? What in the world was God thinking with a crucified Messiah and a group of people like the Corinthians and like you and me? What was God thinking using broken vessels to share his message with the world? Maybe, just maybe, God was thinking that his way, no matter how foolish it might be or seem, is always best. So, Father, we come to you this morning, humbling ourselves and submitting ourselves to your foolishness, to your weakness, which is stronger than anything that we conceive, your foolishness, which is wiser than anything that we conceive. God, thank you that you gave us absolutely no reason to look to ourselves and every single possible reason to look to you. Everything that you did was for your glory, and so that we cannot brag at all about what we did to save ourselves. God, I pray that you would give us boldness, that you would give us courage. Maybe, God, that you would give us weakness and fear and trembling. Maybe that's the better approach as we seek to know nothing except Christ crucified among a lost and broken world. Be with us this week. Speak through us. Tear down the walls of those who we would speak to. God, thank you that we live in a world of technology where we can have services, where we can gather together, even though it's not the same, and we don't want it to be like this forever or for very long. God, help us to be wise as we figure out what's next and what getting together looks like. Help it be soon. Thank you for Jesus, and it's in his name that we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of Washington Avenue Christian Church. If you'd like more information about our church, please go to our website at waccconline.org.